Okay, hi, it's good to be here. My name's Jackie Burke, and I go around schools all over Ireland, north, south, east, and west, and this is the subject that I speak to them about. These are drugs, ladies and gentlemen. Put your tongue back in, you're not getting any. These are drugs, and whenever anybody looks at a case of drugs like this, I'm sure none of us here would have any problem thinking about the stuff at the top, cocaine, cannabis, heroin. Drugs like that, we have no problem thinking about being drugs or being dangerous. But there are other drugs in this case, and it seems to me we'll have a problem thinking about those as being dangerous or being drugs. I mean, take this one here. Well, don't take it. Just have a look at it. This is a drug called tobacco and a number one killer amongst all these other drugs. This one here is alcohol, second only to tobacco as the number one killer. I go into schools, as I say, you know, giving drug education with a difference. And I'm telling you a little bit about the work that I do because I do value your prayer and the work. I know that it's through speaking in groups like this over the years that the work has continued to flourish, and I can tell you that each year I would speak to about 10,000 young people as far down as Roscommon and Dublin and Dundalk, right here in Northern Ireland. And as I said to Keith earlier, ironically, one of the first schools that I spoke at was actually here in Bangor. But that became an academy or something, I think, and they weren't too keen after that. But, you know, you never know. Any young people here who go to schools, maybe have a, I can make you a disciple tonight, and you can insist on having me in to do the full talk. The full talk lasts 2 hours. You'll be glad to hear I'm not going to do it tonight. And I'm well qualified to do these talks. These are my qualifications that I brought with me. Now, this is not a degree from Queen's University in pharmacology, nor is it a degree in psychology or zoology or any of the ologies. What this is what gives me the right to tell you, your young people, something about drugs. And I hope nobody's got one of these in their possession. This was issued by the Police Service of Northern Ireland, formerly known as the RUC, but we'll not get into that, eh? This was issued by the Police Service of Northern Ireland, and what it is a record sheet, or should I say sheets. On these sheets are a list of 22 convictions, all relating to drugs. Possession of cannabis, possession of LSD, possession of amphetamine at speed, forgery, burglary, the list goes on and on. And yes, they all belong to me. Good evening. You're now looking at the most unsuccessful criminal in the whole of Northern Ireland. Now, the forgery convictions were, you see, because I was a registered drug addict with the Home Office. That meant that I got my drugs free of charge from the doctor. Nice trick if you can do it. But these doctors, I knew they were trying to help me, but one of the things I found was that they were never giving me enough, so I thought I'd try and help them out by writing out my own prescriptions. The police didn't like that for some reason. I'm not proud of this stuff. It's my past life, and I thank God it is my past life. I show it when I go into the schools and colleges for one simple reason. I don't want the young people to think they're getting the drugs talk from one of those guys who's been sitting in a library with a book open on drugs going, "Hey, now there's an interesting statistic." I try to give them drug education with reality, and I'm in that place to do it. So I would ask you to keep me in your prayers for the work that's doing. As I say, the 10,000 that I speak to every year is not the big number. As I said to Keith, I'm thank God I can stand here tonight and tell you in the past 16 years of doing this work in the schools and colleges throughout Ireland, I have never known a month, never known 4 weeks to pass without at least hearing directly or indirectly of one person being saved. So it is a work worth praying for, and it is a work that I would ask for your support and prayer in any way you can, okay? The main part of the talk, I do a lot on the drugs with the young people, and so what I want you to do is imagine that you're 16. That might be easier for some of you than others, but you're 16 and you're brought into the school to hear this drugs talk, okay? And you're expecting this guy with books and overhead projectors and all the rest of it, and instead you get me. I do a bit on the drugs for a half an hour, and then I do what is called my life story, in other words, my testimony. And I have to say that I have a welcome in schools that most people would find quite incredible that I am allowed in to give this testimony. And so tonight I'm going to give it to you. Now, to tell you my life story, by the way, I do have a book called No Deals. It was printed, 10,000 copies of it was printed 8 years ago. Basically you wouldn't get it in Easton's or Waterstones if you ordered it, but it would cost you too much. But it's called No Deals by Jackie Burke. You can get it on Amazon. It's one of the main turnovers on Amazon. I don't have a copy with me tonight to show you what it looks like, but if you're interested in a more full story, it's called No Deals. You'll see why it's called No Deals as I tell you my life story. Now, to tell you my life story, the first thing I need to tell you, first of all, is what I'm not. I am not one of these boys that you've seen on the Jeremy Kyle show. I did not take drugs, you know, because my mommy didn't like me. And I didn't take drugs because my daddy beat me. Didn't even take drugs because my auntie fancied me. Sorry about that. I didn't take drugs for any of these reasons. I took drugs as an adventure, an experiment that got out of control. At least that's why I thought I took drugs. Halfway through the life story, I give the young people a chance to find out what I believe is the real reason we humans take drinking drugs. But me, take drink, take drugs, why would I do that? I have a good family, a mother and father who love me, two older brothers, typical Northern Ireland older brothers, go out and fight your battles and then hit you a slap around the head for getting them into trouble. We're a tight, loving family. There's no poverty in our house. We're not rich, but we're not poor. I never knew any poverty growing up. Yet I ended up taking drugs. What went wrong? Well, there was one thing that depressed me growing up. I don't know, I know you'll not identify with this, but one thing that did depress me growing up was Sundays. I hated Sundays. See, on Sundays, my dad would dress me and the two brothers up like dogs dinners. Then he would march us off to the local church. Now, the church I attended, men wore their collars on back to front, and they wore these funny black dresses, and they walked around going like this, Haley, Haley, or they got very excited, Haley. Now, no disrespect to these guys, but I kind of grew up with an attitude that said, you know, God's probably out there. He's on the third cloud from the left. You wave at him on a Sunday, salute, get your card marked. Then you get on with real life. God, he's nothing to do with real life. Don't get me wrong, I never had a problem believing in God. I just had a problem finding out how to have a relationship with him. This attitude was to change about the age of 14. Two influences came into my life that were to pull me in different directions. The first influence was to do with the Holy Rollers. This young curate came into the church. Now, his name was John, and John was a little different. John had long hair. I know today for a minister, a priest, or a pastor to have long hair is not a big thing nowadays, but I'm talking about when I was 14. You know, dinosaurs ruled the earth back then. Not really. I seen this guy with a long hair, and I thought he's one of us. I say one of us because that was the second influence come into my life. Drugs arrived, man. Now, what I'm going to do at this point is what a lot of people do who have a sort of sneaking respect for Christianity, but you don't want to get too involved in it in case it takes over your whole life. So what we do is make a deal. This is how I made my deal. I heard it said somewhere in the Bible, God is love. I thought that'll do me. Went down to see John this day. I said, hey, John, man, see me and Big G? We're like that. He said, what are you talking about, you and Big G? Me and God, we're like that. He said, how do you work at it? I said, well, doesn't it say in the Bible God is love? I said, that's right. I said, well, I believe in peace and love, so I must be all right with God. He said, Jackie, you never know the true meaning of love until you get that relationship with Christ. That's as far as that went. My drug education was now about to begin, and my education wasn't like what I do in the schools. Mine came in the shape of a young fella called Bug. Well, he wasn't actually called Bug. He was 3 foot high, and we were all afraid of standing on him, so we called him Bug. People come with gruel, can't they? Bug came into school one day, and he says, "Jaggy, do you want to try a bit of this?" I says, "What's that?" He says, "A bit of cannabis." I says, "Cannabis? What does it do?" "Oh, it makes you feel giggly, makes you feel relaxed." I said, "All right, I'll try it." I go home on my lunch break to get the money for this bit of dope. Now, there's nobody in the house that day, unfortunately, so I slip upstairs into my brother's bedroom and steal one of his LP records. For you young people, that's a big CD. I brought it in and I swap it for the bit of dope. This guy shows me how to roll a joint. I smoked that bit of dope. I'm not going to tell you any lies here tonight. I smoked that bit of dope and I thought, this is the business. This is the business. It makes me feel giggly, makes me feel relaxed. There's no hangover. It's cheap. All you do is steal your brother's records. Come on, let's not get excited. I'm not going to be a junkie. Junkies put needles in their arms. I'll never do that. I seen a guy on a TV documentary putting a needle in his arm and turned my stomach. I'm frightened of needles. No danger of me being a junkie. I'm just going to smoke a wee bit of dope at the weekend, have a bit of beer. That's as far as it'll go. And you know what? That's as far as it did go for quite a while. I don't have a lot of time for these guys. You see out sometimes with a megaphone in the street shouting, "It was a sorry day, the first day I took a drink, and the worst day I smoked my first joint. I'm 30 years on the road." 30 years on the road. Let's tell the truth about this. If drinking drugs were not a bit of fun to begin with, none of us would try it. Of course, it may be a bit of fun to begin with, but I tell you what, it can catch you. And catch you so fast. You know the amazing thing about it? You don't even realize when you're caught. If you'd have come up to me in the first few years I was taking drinking drugs and said, "Jackie, do you not think you've got a problem?" I'd have said, "Wise up. You know that alcoholic around the corner? There's a guy with a real problem." You never believe it's happening to you. Always someone else. And I was no different. At 15, this other boy came into my school. Sounds like my school was coming down with drugs. It wasn't. This boy came in, he had two black capsules in his hand. "Jackie, do you want to try these?" Well, they all come to me for. I must have looked mad enough to try them. "Jackie, do you want to try these?" I says, "What's that?" He says, "It's speed." I says, "Speed? What does it do?" "Oh," he says, "it hypes you up, makes you feel talkative, keeps you awake." I said, "All right, I'll try them." He gave them to me for nothing. I'm going out of the school and he's shouting, "Jackie, by the way, only take one of those capsules." "All right, don't tell the whole school about it. And have something to eat before you take it." "All right." I get home, open up this tin of cold rice, scoop it into me. I swallow one of these capsules. I wait 5 minutes. When nothing happens, I think, he's probably weighing me up. There's probably nothing in them. And I took the second one. Now, that was a big mistake. That was a very big mistake. Half an hour later, good morning, Vietnam. Alcohol was good, cannabis was good, but this is the business now. I met with a girlfriend that night, a poor girl. I took her to the cinema. She never seen one bit of the movie. "Do you realize how much I love you? I want to talk to you. Never mind the movie. Let me talk to you." I came home, got into bed, everybody else in bed. Me, I'm sitting like a 5:30 in the morning. I'm tiptoeing around the kitchen, trying to make a cup of tea. My dad come down the stairs. "Morning, Dad. What are you doing up so early?" "Oh, I'm getting ready for school. I'm really looking forward to school." "I'm up for 3 days. I cannot stop eating. I cannot eat. I cannot stop talking. Some people think I'm still on it. On the third day, this stuff starts to wear off. I feel sick. I feel depressed. I feel like I've been given a kicking. I will never touch it again. 2 weeks later, I'm trying it again." Now, why do we do that? Why do we continue with something even when we've had a bad experience? I think it's because you always hope to get it right the next time, don't you? Think about it. The first time anybody ever goes out to get drunk, say they drink a bottle of vodka in the mix of some beer. First part of the night, the young fellas go about, "You, you, you girls, dancing queen." Halfway through the night, you get a visit from somebody called Huey. "Oh, Huey." The next morning, you wake up, your head's sore, your stomach's turning, and you're swearing you'll never touch it again. Within 2 seconds, you've got a thought in your head. "Hey, you know where you went wrong last night? If you just drank a half bottle, instead of a full bottle. Try a different combination. You'll get it right the next time. That's what we're all going to do. Find that combination for a high with no low. You never find it, but while you're looking for it, you can become addicted. At 16, I went to England and I joined all these other people taking drugs. You'll have seen it on TV. 500,000 of us in big fields watching groups on stage. Me and my mate, we used to have these very deep, meaningful, philosophical conversations that would go like this. Wow. Then the mate, he'd reply, yeah. That conversation took 3 hours. Life was not terrible, but drugs were taking over. I just didn't realize how fast. Things took a swing for the worst in a most unusual way. I heard about a doctor. Now, you wouldn't think that would do you any harm. Ah, but this doctor, he's giving out drugs on prescription to all the young people. I thought I'll have some of that. But I'm crafty, like, or at least I think I'm crafty. Remember John the Curate? He's at a church over there in London. I go to see him. Hey, John, I think I've got a problem. I hadn't. John, would you help me? He did. He came down and he sat in the doctor's surgery wearing his clerical collar, and I just abused our friendship. I told a little lies about how many drugs I needed to get up in the morning, how many to put me to sleep at night. The doctor looked at my company. He gave me what one doctor back here in Northern Ireland described as a disgusting amount of drugs. He then took my name and put it on a register with the Home Office, with the government. And from that moment on, at 18 years of age, I became a registered drug addict. Drugs, free of charge on the National Health. A dream come true. It was actually the beginning of a nightmare that was to last for many years. Over the years, summing it up, they put me in prison on 4 occasions to scare me off the drugs. Didn't work. Then I said, well, all right, we can't scare this guy off of drugs. I know, let's cure him off them. So they put me in psychiatric and rehabilitation clinics on 7 occasions to cure me off drugs. Didn't work. You know why it didn't work? You know why the police and the prison officers couldn't scare me off it? Why doctors and psychiatrists couldn't cure me? Because they were missing one vital point. Why was I taking drinking drugs in the first place? What was the real reason behind it? This is where I give the young people a chance to find out what I believe is the real reason we humans take drinking drugs. Don't forget, I'm talking to 200 mostly unsaved young people, some of them with no connection or concept of God. This is what I asked them to do. I asked them to close their eyes. You can take part if you like. I asked them to close their eyes and picture this little scene. Picture yourself sitting at home. It's 11:30 tonight. You're watching a DVD on the television. There is one difference. Tonight, you're on your own. Mom, dad, brothers, sisters, whoever you live with, they've gone away on some business. You didn't go with them, so you got a DVD to pass the time. Now, you have no friends around to keep your image up for. You know that image we show each other saying, this is who I am, when we know it's not the full story. 20 minutes to 12, the DVD is over. Watch yourself get up out of the chair. You walk over and switch the television off. Now watch yourself head towards your bedroom. You enter your bedroom, you get undressed, get into bed. Now look at yourself lying in bed. 12 at night, you're now in a deep, peaceful sleep in a quiet, empty house, nothing troubling you. But at 2 o'clock in the morning, for no reason at all, you suddenly wake up. In that moment when you wake, just for a second, you feel a bit frightened. You don't know why you feel frightened, but a thought, a feeling, it's hard to describe. It just flies into your head for no reason. You don't even know why you thought it. And the thought is this, is this all there is? I go to school, I get a certificate, I get a job, I find someone I love, I get married, I have a couple of kids, and then I die. And while I'm doing this, everyone around me, they're going to die. Mom, dad, brothers, sisters, friends. This house will be empty one day, with no memory of me and my family ever having lived here. That's the whole story. That's the purpose. That's it. You got to see 200 mostly unsaved young people at this time. Some of them, the color literally drains from them. The first time I ever did that little scenario was in Five Mile Town High School in a question and answer session. When somebody asked me, why do you think it's only humans take drinking drugs? That scenario poured out of my mouth. I believe it's of the Holy Spirit, but I got to be sure. I don't want to be putting thoughts that aren't there. I prayed and I said, Lord, you got to show me where to keep this in my testimony. The next day I'm in Priory High School or Priory College. I prayed about it and I put it in the middle of the testimony. At the end of the testimony, a 16-year-old boy came up, literally shaking in the spirit. And he said, Jackie, I want to thank you for being here today, but mostly for that bit in the middle. I said, why is that, son? He says, I thought I was the only one who ever had a thought like that. I thought I was going mad. I says, no, son, we've all had those moments when we felt this size in a big universe. See, when you get a thought like that, it makes you feel very empty inside. See that emptiness? That's the real reason we take drinking drugs. I tried to drown that emptiness with alcohol, cover that loneliness in pills, pour a lot of cocaine over for my insecurity. And you know something? Not even heroin, the strongest drug in God's green earth, could keep that emptiness down. You know why? That emptiness is God-shaped, and only God can fill it. I didn't find that out for a long time. I did get off drugs once. I met a girl. I hardly knew her. She was an English girl called Vivian. The two of us got a place together, and after a while, she got pregnant. She gave birth to two little girls, twins, Elizabeth and Laura. Elizabeth died at birth, but Laura lived. I thought, come on, you're a father now. Time to wise up. Be a man. Get off these drugs. And I did. I managed to wean myself down over the next few months off the drugs. Got a job. What a job. Like something you'd see on television with a Lady McNeil Dixon, real aristocracy, the real McCoy. She was from Irish descent. She liked my accent, so she gave me a job in her home. Her home was a place called Lagan Manor, a big manor house with a moat around it, a petrified forest around the moat. I've got a converted stables for a cottage to live in, a car to drive, a good wage, beautiful grounds. It's a perfect place to bring my wee daughter Laura up. 18 months later, I walk out, leaving my daughter behind. Did I not love my daughter? I love my daughter. But for 18 months, every day, all I could get in the back of my head was that same thought, Jackie, stop fooling yourself. You'll never be a father to this wee girl. You'll never keep this job. Get away on back to the drink. Get on back to the drugs. Get on back to what you were made for. And you know something? I knew the thought was right. I came home to Northern Ireland in 1982. My brother Tom, eldest of the family, when Tom found out I was taking these drugs, he tried to help me get off them in every way he could. One of the ways was to bring along his friend alcohol. We used to go drinking in a caravan we had down in Malaylor. I used to go down the weekends with him. He was working. He would pay for the carryouts. I was still taking my pills. In 1986, Tom got a three-week holiday from work. The first week I stayed with him on holiday, but the second week I came home because I heard the housing executive had offered me a flat. I liked the flat, so I go down to the Dole, got some money to furnish it, a bad bit of carpet. I wait on Tom coming home from holiday. First day home from holiday, Tom didn't have a drink. I said, Tom, will you come out and lay that carpet for me? Nah, not today, kid. I'm not feeling the best. All right. Second day home, he still didn't have a drink. Tom, come on out and lay that carpet. All right, he says. He came out and he laid the carpet in the living room floor of my flat. And to thank him, to say thank you to the brother, I bought a bottle of Hennessy brandy and 10 tuber gold beer. I've only one glass in the flat because I've just moved in, a half pint tumbler, so I'll pour him that amount. See that? A large one, a double. He drank it, took a sip of beer. 5 minutes later, he looks like he's drunk. What's wrong with you? I don't know. Most of it I'll drink dynamite from the weekend. What are you going to do? I'll sleep it off. All right. He put the feet up in the bed and he fell asleep. I go downstairs with a carryout. What am I going to do with all this booze? I hear music coming from a flat down below. So I go down. Hello, I'm your new neighbor. Come on in, mate. Join the party. Started drinking with these boys. A couple of hours later, I went back to check on Tom. He was still sleeping. So go back to the party. Stayed in the party to 2 o'clock in the morning, came home, fell asleep on a settee. 9 o'clock the next morning, made a cup of tea, brought it into Tom. He's dead. Alcoholic poisoning. I should take one. One will not do you a button of harm. That's a lie. Let me nail that lie right now. One large brandy and a sip of beer was all it took to take my dear brother Tom off the scene of time into eternity. Here's a bit of drug education for you. 30,000 people die in those kind of circumstances in the United Kingdom every year. Out of that 30,000, nearly a fifth are teenagers. What do we say? One for the road, brother. Well, he took that road and he never came back. How do you feel? You've walked out on your daughter, now you've killed your own brother. My dad, I remember my dad the day at Tom's funeral. He leaned over the coffin, kissed Tom on the forehead, said, "Don't worry, son. You've just gone a little bit ahead of me. I'll not be long behind you." He kept his word. 18 days before the first anniversary of Tom's death, my father died. They say my dad died of a heart attack, and I know that's true. I've seen it happen, but I watched that old man die long before the heart attack. His head went down after Tom's death. He never lifted it again. I tried to take Tom's place in his life. Couldn't do it. My mother, 9 months after that, she's taken into hospital to have a hysterectomy where they take a woman's womb away. They take her womb away and they find 4 spots of cancer. How do you feel? You've walked out on your daughter, you've killed your own brother, your father's died of a broken heart, and now your mother's got cancer. And where are you? Are you there to help your mother? No, you're down in the Crumlin Road prison doing time, feeling sorry for yourself mainly. Well, there are no words to describe how I felt at that time, so I won't bore you with it, but I can't tell you how I tried to deal with it. I came out of prison, I found out my mother was recovering from the cancer, and that gave me the freedom I needed to deal with my pain, the only way I knew how. So I rolled up my sleeve one day, and I stood outside a wee house in Belfast in the back garden of the house on a lovely summer's day. My mate stood with a syringe, and I said, "Hurry up. Is it in yet? Hurry up, get it in." That's how I took my first fix, still frightened of needles. Wasn't how I took my last one. You could hit these arms all day long. All the veins in my arms and hands collapsed through using needles. Remember me? I'm the boy's just going to have a wee smoke of dope and a few beers. Nobody will get hurt. Life, the call of life would be to dress it up, and I don't do that. My existence went like this. I'd get a 2-week prescription for drugs from the doctor, 2 weeks' money off the dole. I'd go on a bender. If it lasted about 10 days before I ran out of drink, drugs, and money. At the end of the 10 days, I'd go to the one place left open to me. Everywhere else had shut their doors on me. Family, friends, doctors, social workers had all given up. I don't blame them. One person hadn't given up. That was my mother. My mother lived in a wee pensioner's bungalow. And the front part of that bungalow was her bedroom. And the back part was a wee box room where she single-handedly dragged in a wee bed and a dressing table just for me. I would turn up at the door, broke, sober, tired. She'd bring me in, let me have a bath, clean set of clothes, clean bed to lie down in. Over the next few days, she'd run in with trays of food, nursing me back to health, getting me ready for the next bender. Everybody said to her, "Throw him out. Do you not see he's only using you? Put him out, he's no good." She wouldn't do that. See, my mother was a Christian, and she believed that one day Christ could change things. She believed it so much, she used to write a wee note. This is what she wrote. "Please pray for my son Jackie, a drug addict, from a loving mother. Please pray for my son Jackie, a drug addict, from a loving mother." She would take this wee note, she'd get on buses, trains, any way she could travel, went all around this country with it. One night she actually walked 4 miles in the rain to get to one church. When she got to that church, the gates were locked, so she stuck the note on the gate and walked 4 miles home. Normally what you do is wrap the note around a coin, drop it into a box, put it on a plate, anywhere it might be found, looking for prayer from as many people as possible. When I say she asked everyone for prayer, I do mean everyone. Desperation has no denomination. Didn't look like anything would ever change. 20 years ago, she's gone off the hospital to have a wee cataract operation on her eye. Not a serious operation, but at her age, it's always serious. It's 8:15 in the morning. I'm going down to the doctor's to get my drugs. I'll be the good son this morning. I'll call and see my mother. All the best for the operation. She says, son, sit down and have a cup of tea with me. Well, I can't, you know, a bit of business to do. She knew what the business was. Son, sit down and have a cup of tea. I have a cattle on. I have a taxi order for 8:45 to take me to the Royal Victoria Hospital. Come on, you give a woman like that 15 minutes of your time. Not when you get caught up in drinking drugs. She goes off the hospital alone and frightened. I get my drugs. I take them over the next day and a half. Nothing unusual in any of this. 8:00 in the evening, I've no drink, no drugs, no money left. I'm thinking about a place to sleep. I don't want to go out to that flat of mine, the state of it. Wonder if that other brother been around to walk my mum's wee dog while she's in the hospital. If he's out with a dog, he may have left the side door of the bungalow open. I can maybe climb in. I'll go and check it out. I climb up a side gate, I see the doors open, brilliant. Throw myself over, slip inside, get into the wee box room, get undressed, get into bed. I want to get to sleep before he comes back. If he finds me awake, he might ask me to leave, but if he finds me sleeping, he'll leave me alone. I'm looking for a good night's sleep. That's all I'm looking for. Just a good night's sleep. God? Don't be talking to me about God. If God's there, he's deaf. I have no time for God. Oh, but I thank God tonight he had time for me. 4:00 that morning, I wake up with this prayer pouring out of my mouth, the same prayer over and over. Father, please don't let me die like this. Don't let me die like this. Why am I praying? I wouldn't usually. I tried to get out of bed and I soon found out my legs buckled beneath me and I hit the floor. It's barbiturate poison. It numbs your body as it travels to your heart. It can kill you. I know what I need to do. I need to get into the Lagan Valley Hospital, get a saline drip put in and get my system cleaned out. And I need to do it quickly. I know this because I've taken overdoses in the past. I know the problem and I know the solution. But I know something else. There's a presence in that room with me. And he's more real than you sitting here right now. And I've heard about him from his sight. His name, Jesus Christ. I crawl in the living room, get up on a settee, lay down on a settee. You know what the Son of God does? Starts to turn the pages of my memory. Showing me how many times from I've been a little boy. He said, Jackie, you've done that. Would you not come to me? You've tried that. Would you not come to me? And I've said, hold on, Lord. Let me make a deal. You know something? 4:00 in the morning, I'm dying here. Christ is with me and his presence is real as you now. Asking me to come to him for healing, for help. What would I do for the next hour and a half? You never believe it. Still try to make a deal. Still try to make a deal. Look, Lord, I know you're here, but if you would heal me now, I'll cut down on my drugs. I'll be a better son to my mother. I'll even go to church once in a while. I didn't realize God doesn't make deals. 5:30 that morning, I found out he didn't make deals. No, I found out his presence just suddenly left. I tell you, when that happened, depression, abandoned hope. I just sat there and cried for the next hour and 20 minutes. I knew I'd missed an opportunity and may never come again. 7:10 that morning, the poison in my body has got so bad, the only part of me working is my elbows. I'm pulling myself across the carpet. I'm going to ring for an ambulance, and I'm looking at you straight in the face when I tell you this. Only by the grace of God, I'm going to that phone. I didn't want an ambulance. I knew I'd missed an opportunity, may never come again. As I get to the phone, I realize it's ringing. Hello? Hello, Mr. Burke. This is the Royal Victoria Hospital. Look, we're a bit concerned. Your mother's had her operation successfully, but she wants to sign herself out a day early to be with you. Will you be there to help her when she arrives home? She'll have a patch over her left eye and she'll need your help. I'll be here. But I wouldn't be there. I need to get in the hospital myself and get a saline drip in. How could I be there for my mother? And you know something? It was just that wee thought. No great faith, just that wee thought that made me call out more in desperation than in faith. Lord Jesus, I'm begging you. Will you please come back? give me one last chance. If you do, I promise, no deals. You can take my life and do what you want with it. 6:50 that morning, I couldn't have done this. 1, 2, 3. Couldn't have taken 3 simple steps for myself. 7:10, I was standing with a Hoover in my hand, getting the place cleaned up, ready for my mother coming home. Healed and totally delivered from the so-called life that I once had. You're not looking at a rehabilitating addict here tonight. Somebody went into the hospital for the rehab. You're looking at someone who took a hand of Christ and was set free. When Jesus Christ set you free, you're free. When the Son of God healed you, you're healed. See, over the next 4 days, the least I should have had coming off my drug so hard in withdrawal was to have a thing called a grand mal seizure. It's a huge epileptic fit that I always had in withdrawal. The least it should have been done, put in the hospital, and over not less than 2 months, brought down gradually for drugs I was taking. I didn't even break sweat. Didn't even need an aspirin. No, why? Because when Christ heals you, you're healed. When he sets you free, you're free. My God is a God of second chances. I'll give you 2 examples of the thousands I could tell you about from that day to this. My mother and I used to meet every day face to face or on the phone. At the end of the conversation, the one question she'd always ask, Jackie, before you go, where are you going tomorrow? Oh, tomorrow I'm way down the Hammond Road in Bangor. By what time would you be telling them about what Christ can do for them? Just round about now, Mom, round about now. That wouldn't be an idle question. She should ask that question because she wanted to be sure to be praying, only not praying for me, praying for you. Praying that this isn't when your head is some wee talk you can forget 5 minutes later. It's into your heart. Doesn't teach you about the reality of drugs. A good lesson. Teach you something else about the reality of the love of Christ. On the 6th of July 2009, my mother passed away to be with the Lord. The very last thing she said to me before she left this world was, Jackie, I love you, son, and I want you to know I'll always be praying for you. Now, whether it's theologically correct or not, I don't know. My spirit seems to tell me there may be somebody praying for us tonight. My God is a God of second chances. You know my wee daughter Laura, tried everything to get in touch with Laura, made phone calls, sent letters, got them returned, not knowing at this address. A lot of years ago in the Sacred Heart School up in Oma, of all places, a young girl come up to me and said, tell me this, do you ever see your daughter? No. Do you ever think about her? Every day. She walked away with tears in her eyes. I knew what she was really saying. She was saying, you know, my dad walked out on me and I was wondering, did he ever think about me? Really, because of her, I come home that day and I have one of them great times when you don't talk to God, be your mouth, it'll be your heart. Lord, I need your help. I need to put it right by Laura. A week later, the phone rang. My daughter Laura. And amongst a lot of tears and happiness, I was able to tell that wee girl something really important. I didn't walk out because I didn't love you. I was driven out by drinking drugs. I didn't say, well, I think I'll go into rehab. No, I took a hand of Christ. That's what changed me. You know my amazement? She was so happy, not just to hear that I've been healed and set free, but she was so happy even when I told her, you know, love, your dad's got married since you become a Christian. You've got a wee half brother. His name's Matthew. Matthew was 17 on his last birthday. Just 14 years ago, I was able to tell you if I got a half-sister. Rachel was born 14 years ago. And just to make matters even better, 9 years ago, Jonathan joined the Burke household. Before I finish, I would invite you to take a last look at me. To see right this minute, you're having the great privilege of looking at the best father, the very best father in the whole of Ireland, next year on. Christ, give me my second chance. I've taken mine. Have you taken yours? Thanks a lot.